Now, let's turn to Evan Bogart. You may not know his name, but I'm sure you've heard his music. In the summer of 2008, Evan Bogart went to visit his friend, Ryan Tedder. Evan Bogart is a music executive. Tedder is a lead singer in the pop rock band One Republic. Tedder was recovering from an injury he got on tour, and they could have lounged around watching movies, but instead, they headed into Tedder's home studio. 3 hours later, they walked out with a song that would become this. You're everything I need and more. It's written all over your face. Baby, I can feel your halo. Pray it won't fade away. Beyoncé's Halo won the Grammy for Best Female Pop Vocal Performance in 2010 and peaked at number 5 on the Billboard charts. Evan Bogart has also written songs for Rihanna, Jennifer Lopez, Enrique Iglesias, among others, and he's the executive producer of the new Bravo series Platinum Hit. For those of you out there wrestling with the keyboard and pen, what do you want to know from Evan Bogart? If you're just a music lover, what do you think makes a hit song? Give us an example, 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at the website, npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Music executive and songwriter Evan Bogart joins us now from NPR West in Culver City. Welcome to the program, sir.
Hey, how are you?
Great. So after that jam session with Ryan Tedder, how did this song end up in Beyonce's hands?
It's actually crazy. We wrote it and sent it to Jay Brown, who is with Roc Nation and who is one of the A&Rs for her record. And like an hour later, hit us back and said, please do not send this to anyone else.
So what, he had called Beyonce or what?
Yeah, I mean, I guess he went, maybe he had been in the studio with her, sent it to her. Maybe he just said, like, we're taking it, and then played it for Beyonce. I'm not sure exactly what went on his end, but we knew, you know, an hour later. It's funny, we actually sent it to him without a bridge. Huh. And we got so excited the next day, we were like, let's write the bridge. And we spent an additional 3 hours just working on the bridge, which she ended up taking off the song anyway.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, it's hard to imagine that song in any voice other than Beyonce's at this point.
No.
It
was written for her.
Really?
Yeah.
So when you guys are in the studio, are you pretending to be her?
We put on wigs. No. No, you know, we were channeling, you know, that day was interesting because we were channeling, obviously Ryan was injured and whatnot, and we were channeling like what kind of song would be great for Beyonce at this point in her career and what's going on in her life. And we're both really big fans of an artist named Ray LaMontagne.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a huge fan of his song Shelter that's on his first album. And I kept saying to Ryan, I was like, you know, what if we wrote like a shelter for Beyonce, like something that's like Beyonce and Jay-Z, and it just is like, mm-hmm. I'm there for you. I got you. Like, I'll always be your encompassing halo, basically. And you know, Ryan started hitting these angelic kind of pads on the keys, and I was like, let's call it Halo, and we just kind of just rolled with it.
Wow. Okay, let's step back for a second.
Sure.
And underneath everything that you're saying, which is a fascinating story, is this idea that you're in there trying to write a song that you want to be popular, make money, get on the radio, sort of, is it a commodity?
That's interesting. Sometimes you go into a session, it's really hard to go into a session thinking like, I'm going to write a hit. I think I'd like to say that like 90% of the time that anybody goes into a session saying, let's write a hit, usually they do not write a hit. In that case, it was more about like, let's write a song that we thought was appropriate for Beyonce and her life at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It just happened to be a great song. So, you know, and we actually left there and Ryan was like, it's a smash, right? It's a smash. And I'm like, yeah, it's really good. And like, I'm like really careful to say a song is a smash just because so many other stars have to align before a song becomes a hit. You know, not only does a song have to be good, the right artist has to cut it. It has to be the right time of their career, the right push by the label. You know, like you never know if they're going to go out and get into a fight or like get arrested. I mean, like there's so many things that have to align in order for a song from the minute you write it to actually become a hit song. You know, I'm really careful about calling a song a hit or a smash until it actually becomes a hit or a smash. But we definitely had that feeling, and the intent. I never have the intent of going in and saying, like, I need to write a song that I can exploit to as many people as possible. I go in there saying, like, I want to have fun. I want to write a song. I want to tailor it for the artist that we're writing it for or with. And, you know, whatever happens is not in our hands. You know, it's in the universe's hands.
I want to make sure that our listeners out there get in some questions for you, because you are a rare opportunity for them. Give us a call at 800-989-8255 or send us an email at talk@npr.org. You know, something always occurs to me when I have this kind of conversation, and I also looked at your new show on Bravo called Platinum Hit, and it seems like all that you're talking about and what all of the contestants on your show, which is like Project Runway or Top Chef, they're going after this specific kind of songwriting. We're not talking about people who are sitting down, the Bob Dylans of the world, expressing their world through the, it's not the poetry, is it? Or am I underestimating it?
I think you're slightly underestimating it. I think in this last week in episode 3, which was like the Road Rules, there was a song that I don't know if I want to ruin it if people haven't seen it, but there's a song that was really good. I won't say where it ended up, called Where I Need to Be, that was written by three of the contestants, Johnny, Brian, and Scotty, which is actually one of my favorite songs probably ever. I mean, it's a really beautiful song, and it's really poetic. I mean, and even the things that they come up with in there. I mean, I don't know if the song could be a commercial hit. And it gets really, again, it depends on like who would cut it and who would push it and what would make sense. But as far as actually songwriting things go, they weren't trying to write a hit. They were just trying to write a beautiful poetic song, and
that,
it worked.
That segues perfectly to this email we have from Brendan. He asks, what's the best way to get your songs out there for performers and record companies to read or hear?
You know, I mean, I think it's a lot about networking. You know, I think a lot of this business is unfortunately who you know.
Get a bus ticket, move to L.A.
Yeah, really, honestly, like the majority of the songwriting community lives in L.A. I call L.A. Pop Nashville now, because all of like a lot of the great writers in L.A. and New York and Atlanta, even the pop writers from Nashville, Miami, Detroit, Chicago, they're all here. And a lot of them from London and Sweden have moved out to L.A. It's become like the mecca of songwriting.
Interesting.
I mean, other than obviously, if you're going to write country music, you have to be in Nashville. I get that, you know. But, you know, I think coming out to LA, meeting people, collaborating with people, having an open mind, you know, and really being persistent. I mean, I think it's really funny, you know, a lot of people that are impossible to get in touch with, if you tweet them, they seem to respond. I think actually putting it out into a public forum that you're hitting them up, people don't want to be embarrassed, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but It's funny. Like, a lot of networking that's hard to do in person, I see a lot of up-and-coming writers connect with some big producer and writers and artists through Twitter and through Facebook.
Hey, people, get on the social networking.
Yeah, you got to work your brand, you know?
Let's go with Mike in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Go ahead, your question for Evan Bogart.
Yeah, so I wanted to know if there is a certain, I guess you call it, minimum number of markets or minimum number of stations that a tune, a new song, has to be heard on before it takes off. Is there some idea of how many times it has to be heard, or does this, how does it get to a point of it being, I guess the best word is...
A smash, yeah, as Mr. Bogart keeps saying.
You know, that's interesting. I think that personally, I won't even tell people I have a single unless it's gone past 2,000 spins on the radio, because unless it's starting to break into 2,000, 3,000 world and is really starting to move up the chart, I don't want to say like, yeah, I have their single. And then all of a sudden, like next week, the label's like, yeah, we're moving on to another song. And it's like, I guess I don't have their single. And I've seen a lot of that happen. I think a lot of people, you know, rush to like, you know, brag about their songs on the radio. I think you have to get, you know, you have to get some serious markets. Either go strong from the secondaries and build it there and build a story there before you go to the major markets. Or if you can get one of the major market radio stations to jump on early, a lot of the other radio stations will follow.
Thanks.
I mean, there's two angles to go at it, but they're both equally difficult and they're both equally crowded. And, you know, it's really about, again, it's really about the stars aligning.
Thanks for your call, Mike.
Thank you.
We're going to go to more questions in just a second, but I want to point out and tell our listeners out there that Mr. Bogart here has discovered some very successful artists. You found Eminem.
Yeah.
Maroon 5. You were a 16-year-old intern at Interscope Records. Tell me the story about finding Eminem.
I was 16 as an interning. I was 18. I was in the mailroom. I got hired there. And about 3 months of being in the mailroom, Tom Wally, who was the president of Interscope at the time, pulled me out of the mailroom and put me basically in charge with him and his team of this posthumous Tupac album. Tupac had died. Uh-huh. Death Row was no longer with Interscope. And Tom pulled me out of the mailroom and was basically like, look, I'm going to teach you how to make a record. And while I was working on that record, a friend of mine, a DJ by the name of Cassidy, invited me to a freestyle contest in Inglewood. I kind of bounced out of the studio, almost got fired for it, got scolded really bad. And, you know, when I got down there, he was like, you got to check out this, like, white kid rapping. He's incredible. He's incredible. And I, being a former rapper myself, I was obviously very, very interested. So, I just sat there with my mouth open, just watching him just destroy one person after another person, kind of like, you know, watching the movie 8 Mile, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah. That is basically the storyline, isn't it?
Yeah. And then afterwards I approached him and his manager at the time, this guy named Mark Kempf, and, asked them, you know, for a demo. And then we're, you know, stayed in touch over the next 3, 4, 5 months, trying to get people at Interscope into it. There was a lot of resistance. Obviously the white rap thing wasn't, you know, really popular at the time. And, he was saying some pretty risque and different things, and you know, it was difficult. But I stayed in touch with his then new manager, current manager Paul Rosenberg, and you know, the Bass Brothers, who he was signed to a production deal with in Detroit, and mm-hmm. Eventually he came out to L.A. and we somehow got the tape to Jimmy, into Jimmy's office, and Dre heard it at Jimmy's house, and 3 days later he was in the office being signed.
Wow, wow! You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. My guest is Evan Bogart. He's a kingmaker in the world of pop and a maker of hits for the pop makers themselves. Let's go to Sean now in Dayton. Hi, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, go ahead.
Okay, well, I got a question. I'm a huge fan of bands like Pink Floyd and, you know, the older school bands of, you know, classic rock. And, I just wanted to comment on the disappearance of the album format in current music today, and how the singles have been affecting the sale of, I guess, the actual full form album, and I guess, you know, the state of the albums today.
Thanks for your call, Sean. It's Evan Bogart. Is the album dead?
No, it's actually not. I'm actually glad that he said that, because if you look at the singles charts and the albums chart, especially if you look on like iTunes right now, I feel that there's becoming a very very specific and distinctive divide between the two. There are definitely a lot of singles that break through, and a lot of those poppier singles, which I'm obviously very excited and guilty of writing, you know, perform very well on the singles charts and perform very, very well at radio, but don't necessarily result in album sales, which is what he's referring to. But if you look at a lot of the iTunes album charts over the course of the last, like, maybe 6 months, maybe even a little longer, you start seeing, like, Fleet Foxes, The Civil Wars, Mumford & Sons, Adele, like, a lot, Foster the People, like, a lot of really great new acts that don't have singles that are really, really popping off, and that are very album-oriented and very artist- and brand-oriented, that are really starting to come to the forefront. And it's exciting for me, because I think as the majors get smaller, and as that world their importance starts to shrink, and as the internet becomes such an important pro asset to music, a lot of these bands that are either signed to indies or on their own find an equal playing field in reaching fans. And it's funny, a long time ago, like, everybody, you know, it wasn't even that long ago, people were saying, the internet's killing the music industry, and everybody kept saying, once the music industry figures out how to use the internet as an asset, it'll revive everything. What actually happened was the artists themselves learned how to use the internet as an asset. It's become a weapon for artists themselves. So through internet, through viral, you start seeing the Florence and the Machines and the LaRues and everybody else who, like, maybe wouldn't get a shot at a major, starting getting signed by majors. And because majors are like, well, we want to be in on that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the playing field is incredibly even right now. And it's very similar to, like, the 1960s, when it was very single-oriented. And then a lot of the independent record labels started popping up in the 70s and became the future majors.
I see.
And I think we're on the verge of a golden era of music. I think that you're going to see a lot more album-oriented acts, and a lot of acts that will break without singles. That being said, when a song like Rolling in the Deep dominates the top 40 chart, mm-hmm. it tells me that everybody's hungry for something different. That's not just a four on the floor, same synth chords played in a different way that has the F word in the title. Like, people are hungry for something more than just the pop stuff. But people still love, like, you know, the mind-numbing pop stuff that they can just sit back and not think about. So it's a really cool dynamic, you know. I'm very hopeful about the future of music right now.
Like,
I couldn't be more excited about it.
I love that you say you're guilty as well. I mean, it sounds like you have this sort of love-hate relationship with pop, and reflected that in that is some of the email we're getting. We have from Mark. He says, "Can you please make a song without autotune?"
I do. I make songs that Beyonce doesn't use autotune.
And let me ask another question from Rob here. Can you talk a bit about the production process for the backing tracks?
Of just in general?
Yeah, he says it seems we've gone away from the era of live recordings toward this sort of overdubs and artificial kinds of strings and so on.
Yeah, you know, I think there's been a lot. There's definitely, you know, I mean, you listen to production this last year, especially when it was very dance oriented and it was like very Afrojack and Guetta and everything like that. I always kept saying, well, this is like the future that we always like imagined in movies, you know, like in Demolition Man. Like, this is the future. The only thing we're missing is like flying cars and hoverboards, you know, like everything's become techno. We had this like image of everybody dressing in like crazy outfits and tech and playing techno music. And if you look at Will.i.am, he's like a cliche of what we thought the future was going to look like. You know, it's like, it's awesome though. It's like, we said it was, you know, we made all the movies in the '80s about it. Right now it's here. Right. So, you know, I think that again, a lot of the bands that I'm just talking about that are selling albums have a very incredible touring bass and use a lot of live instruments as well as synth instruments. You know, I think it's embracing the future, but keeping the musicality alive. I think it's the combination of the two that we'll see a lot in the future.
Evan Bogart, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Evan Bogart is a music executive and songwriter. He's a producer on the new Bravo reality series Platinum Hit, and he joined us today from our studios at NPR West in Culver City. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow, did an injection of stem cells fix a Yankee pitcher's injured arm? Join Ira Flatto on Talk of the Nation Science Friday for a look at the sometimes controversial medical treatments athletes try to stay in the game. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Andrea Seabrook.